Tale of Two Kingdoms, number 69, The Glorious Revolution, May 12, 2002. Okay, well, once again, we're going to get halfway to the end today, I hope. So, last week, after brief, further, yet inconclusive discussion of covenanter slaves in the colonies, we discussed some of the covenanter resistance, went on to the killing times, or we should say maybe the peak of the killing times. And again, when we're talking about this, referring here primarily to field killings, you know, without any other form of justice. And the peak of this was in the first half of 1685. We described four martyrs as representatives: John Brown and Priestill, the two Margarets, and Andrew Hislop. The Scottish Parliament met in 1685 and passed a number of acts to support the persecution of Covenanters, although it is hard to see how any more were really necessary. Another type of Parliament, the United Societies, met in May of 1685 and drafted the Protestation and Apologetic and Admonitory Declaration of the Contending and Suffering Remnant of the True Presbyterians of the Church of Scotland against the proclaiming James, Duke of York, King of Scotland, England, France, and Ireland, the lawfulness of the present pretended Parliament and the apparent inlet of popery, etc., which we discussed at some length, a little bit longer than it takes to read the title anyways. Although the field killings decreased abruptly in the summer of 1685, persecution continued, with many Covenanters being kept in foul prisons or sentenced to transportation. Some continued to be executed, such as John Nisbet. In 1686, when James couldn't get a new parliament to pass an act giving Catholics greater freedom to worship, he dissolved the parliament, changed the Privy Council membership, and had them pass the act that he wanted in August of 1686. Then we close with a brief discussion of some of the dissension in the ranks of the Covenanters, including differences over Renwick's ordination. And these differences affected even Alexander Peyton, who at least met Renwick in the end and repented that he had listened to the slanders. One event I skipped over last week was the meeting of the United Societies in Blackannock on the 7th of April, 1686. All right, I did mention that Renwick had been slandered by some, including those who should have been on his side and were in Holland. Hewison said that the over-righteous runaways from peril could in Holland defame him as a poor, blown-up, illiterate person who, with 100 silly, poor, daft bodies, went about the country robbing. These slanders made it imperative that a general meeting held at Blackannock on 7th April 1686 should authorize Renwick, Boyd, Hill Wilson, and Michael Shields, brother of Alexander, to draft a vindication of the remnant. At this meeting, it was also resolved that members should come to conventions armed for their own and the brethren's defense. We'll have to discuss if we need such a such a resolution in our own church. The Vindication itself was published in March of 1687 and has also a lengthy title: An Informatory Vindication of a Poor, Wasted, Misrepresented Remnant of the Suffering, Anti-Popish, Anti-Prelatic, Anti-Erastian, Anti-Sectarian, True Presbyterian Church of Scotland United Together in a General Correspondence, by way of reply to various accusations and letters, informations, and conference given forth against them. Although it has a long title, it is reputed to be an able defense of the society men's principles, and apparently, I've not actually seen it, I'm just relying on accounts of what other people have written, but it supposedly does rebut the accusation that they're schismatic, despite the title sounding very separatist. According to Hewison, it challenged the allegation that the remnant were revolutionary, set on an unjustifiable regime of the Covenant of Reformation. It declared that they were neither separatists nor a new church, but only the unconquered remnant of the historic Church of Scotland. James continued on his course of reintroducing Catholicism. He wrote a new indulgence in February of 1687. This one allowed moderate Presbyterians to worship in private houses and to hear indulged ministers. Quakers were allowed to meet in licensed meeting houses. Roman Catholics were given liberty to worship in private houses and chapels, not in the fields or Protestant churches. That worship not to include processions in the high streets of royal boroughs. Okay, the penal laws were abrogated and political equality was restored to the Catholics. The concessions were granted on the condition that the acceptors signed an oath acknowledging the absolute authority of the king, his heirs, and his successors. So, all penal sanctions against dissenters, except conventiclers, were eliminated. And this made way for the reestablishment of Roman Catholic worship in chapels. Schools and printing presses were also set up by the priests. Okay, and so one of James's goals was a relaxation of the laws against Catholics and an eventual reestablishment of Catholicism. And early on, he tried to work, I think, within the Anglican Church to do that, and then later he sort of shifted gears and tried to work with the tried to boost up the dissenters, where if he could boost dissenters, he could also sort of reintroduce Roman Catholicism into public life. It's also true, though, at this time, some Presbyterian ministers returned home and accepted, you know, this indulgence, where Hewison says they were able to become useful pastors again. Rennick continued preaching, and he rejected the indulgence. Okay, he was busy, this is Hewison, busy in all directions, preaching even so near the capitals on the Braid Hills. Comforting riding after many a race and chase, the bold youth ventured again into Edinburgh to stay in the Castle Hill with John Luckup. Luckup's house was a rendezvous of wanderers, right? Wanderers are another word for the Covenanters that were reduced to wandering, and the store of uncustomed English goods. There lay safe the papers of Henry Hall's son and of Alexander Shields. Luckup was a suspect. John Justice discovered Rennick and brought a party of tollers of excisemen, ostensibly to examine Luckup's merchandise on the 1st of February, in reality to apprehend Rennick and get the reward. Pistol in hand, Rennick cleared a way for himself and friends through the ring of searchers and made down Castle Lynn for the Cowgate Head. In his flight, he got a disabling blow from a staff, and after several falls, his feeble frame was caught and held by a lusty pursuer. When the comely youth was brought into the presence of Patrick Graham, captain of the guard, he exclaimed, "What is this boy, Mr. Rennick, that the Dacian hath been so much troubled with?" So, Rennick is captured on the 1st of February, 1688. He was tried on the 8th of February. He denied the terms of the indictment, that he had shaken off the fear of God, since the fear of offending God had brought him there. He justified his principles in confession that the king was no longer lawful sovereign according to God's word, the ancient laws of Scotland, and the covenants. Said that it was unlawful to pay cess to suppress the gospel, right? That's a tax that was being charged to support the persecution. That it was lawful to use arms to justify or to resist unjust violence. And holding such views, there's only one possible outcome. It wasn't necessary to call any witnesses. He was condemned to be executed in the Grass Market 2 days later, on the 10th of February, 1688. Interestingly enough, there was quite a bit of interest in figuring out a way to grant him a reprieve. His execution was delayed for a week, and he had, it would appear, a steady stream of visitors who tried to convince him to make some acknowledgement of the king's authority. Several influential Episcopalians, including Bishop Patterson, visited him. Bishop Patterson didn't use his invention, the thumbscrews, on him. So... the Lord Advocate Dalrymple visited him, and Hewison says priests, prelatists, and the indulged Presbyterians were allowed to try him as if he were a Jesuit. In other words, get him to recant some part of his testimony. I read somewhere that somebody said that if he would so much as allow one ink to drop on a piece of paper, go that far towards acknowledging the king's authority, he could get a reprieve. But in the event. He was executed on the 17th of February, 1688, and this is Hewison's account. The fatal day arrived, 17th February. When the drums beat for the guard to take him to execution, he said to his mother, "Yonder is the welcome warning to my marriage. The bridegroom is coming. I am ready. I am ready." In a transport of joy, he walked to the scaffold. Amid the tattoo of drums, he sang the 103rd Psalm, read the 20th chapter of the Revelation, prayed and addressed the audience till he was forced up the ladder. "Spectators," said he, "I am this day to lay down my life for these three things. One, for disowning the usurpation and tyranny of James, Duke of York. Two, for preaching that it was unlawful to pay the cess, expressly exacted for the bearing down of the gospel. Three, for teaching that it was lawful for people to carry arms for defending themselves in their meetings for the persecuted gospel ordinances. I think a testimony for those is worth many lives, and if I had 10,000, I would think it little enough to lay them all down for the same." The drums never ceased until the struggles of one of the noblest martyrs for religion and fatherland had ended. So, although Rennick was at that time the only minister of the United Societies, Hewison mentions that he had a colleague, David Houston, who was arrested in Ireland. I don't know if he was had also been ordained and was, you know, trying to make his way back to Scotland or what, but he was arrested in Ireland and sent to Edinburgh. And while being escorted overland, a rescue was attempted by the Covenanters. They did succeed, but Houston was injured, badly wounded, and incapacitated for the ministry in the attempt. They then sent one Mr. Thomas Lining to be to the Holland to be cleanly ordained by the classes in Emden. Let's see, Lining, I know after the Revolution was to return and be a minister in the Church of Scotland. But I don't think he came back and served the societies prior to the Revolution. This rescue attempt of Houston sent one last flurry of military action into southwest Scotland. Some have said that Rennick was the last Covenanter martyr. Hewison thinks anyways that the last martyr was one George Wood, who was apparently shot in July of 1688. According to Hewison, Wood was a boy of 16 whom Reed shot without asking him a question, afterwards justifying his ruthless act by saying he knew him to be one of the Whigs and they ought to be shot wherever they are found. Okay, well, the persecution of the Covenanters was to be ended shortly by the Glorious Revolution. We'll get to that in a minute. But it might be of some interest to see the scope and breadth of the persecution in numerical terms. John Howey, author of The Scots Worthies, estimated that 18,000 people suffered death or the utmost hardships and extremities in the years between 1660 and 1688. He estimated that 1,700 were sent to the plantations, 750 were banished to the Northern Islands, 200 were willfully murdered, 3,600 were imprisoned, confined, or the like. 800 were outlawed, 55 were sentenced to be executed when apprehended, 680 were killed in skirmishes or died of their wounds from the same, 7,000 were voluntarily banished, 498 were murdered in cold blood without process of law, 362 were executed by form of law. And then he says, the number of those who perished through cold, hunger, and other distresses contracted in their flight to the mountains, and who sometimes even when on the point of death were murdered by the bloody soldiers, cannot well be calculated, but will certainly make up the number above specified. Some later authors think he was probably overestimated, but I haven't seen anyone who tried to seriously count the numbers and then say overestimated. Just thought that he overestimated. Okay, well, then the Glorious Revolution, or so-called Glorious Revolution. Meanwhile, back in England, James was having some serious problems. I know we've seen in the first part of the class, we often covered events in England, but in the second part, we didn't have too much recourse to do that, but to cover the Glorious Revolution, we do have to kind of go back and look at what was happening. In 1686, James had suspended the Bishop of London for failing to suppress anti-Catholic sermons. And he banished the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Sancroft, from court because he refused to support toleration. James's April of 1687 indulgence got him further set at odds with the episcopal hierarchy. He reissued the Declaration of Indulgence in May of 1688 and ordered that this time it be read in the churches. Okay, and the Episcopal bishops were between a rock and a hard place. They didn't want to read it, but refusing to do that could get them suspended or banished. they organized and decided to petition the king to withdraw his order rather than to force the churchmen to obey it. He had them tried for sedition and put them in the Tower of London while awaiting trial. This was a public relations disaster. James's advisors actually suggested that he go ahead and give them a general pardon, but he was stubborn and refused to do so. He replaced the number of officers of state with Catholics. Then he replaced half of the royal judges, thereby packing the court. And he got a court decision from them that allowed him to dispense with laws by fiat. Okay, so anything the Parliament passed and he had signed previously or had been, you know, passed by Charles, he could X off. In 1686, he replaced more than 250 justices of the peace with Catholics. I mean, it wasn't just at the national level, it was also going into local boroughs and so on and replacing them. Let's see, according to one modern historian, Catholics were commissioned into the county militia and more Catholic officers were appointed to posts in the standing army. The universities, training ground for the Anglican Church, had Catholics imposed upon them, beginning with the head of chapel at Oxford and a master of a college at Cambridge. Okay, then to make matters worse, a son was born to James on the 10th of June, 1688. There were rumors that the son really wasn't born to him, they'd been smuggled in, but sort of regardless, now there was an heir to the throne. And this offered up the possibility of a permanent Catholic succession. Up until now, the heir to the throne, or heiress to the throne, had been James's daughter, Mary, who was a Protestant. She was married to the Dutch Protestant William of Orange, who was also grandson of Charles I through Charles's daughter, Mary Stuart. And he was third in line for the English throne. So even he was a prince in Holland. He'd been fighting the French Catholics there. He was, I don't know anything about him personally, but he was sort of a hero of the Protestants there. So up until the birth of the prince, the English naturally looked to Mary, and you know, certainly there's always the possibility they get William as part of the bargain. So there were a lot of behind the scene discussions. Gilbert Burnett, the Episcopal bishop that had to flee the country, was in Holland. And there was a lot of talk going back and forth. But he received a formal invitation by seven prominent politicians on the 30th of June, 1688, to come to England. 4 months later, on the 5th of November, 1688, he arrived in England with an army and proclaimed that he was there. He had arrived to preserve and maintain the established laws, liberties, and customs. By the time James realized what was going on, it was too late. For him, he thought the Dutch were preparing for action against the French, with whom they had been at war. James tried a political solution. He also joined his army in the field, but he lost his nerve and concluded that the army was not up to the task. Two of his senior commanders then switched over to William. Up until this point, there was the possibility of a fairly even battle, at least plausibly even. James had 25,000 men. William had 20,000 men, but they were professional soldiers. But he also had all of the logistics problems of an invading army. Admittedly, the not completely hostile territory, but still, I mean, I don't think it was a foregone conclusion that one side or the other would win from a military standpoint. Shortly thereafter, James sent his wife and son to France, and then he tried to flee London himself. You may find this story humorous. This is from a book, fairly modern book, by Mark Schlansky, who's a professor at Harvard. He says, "It is unclear who was more disconcerted by what happened next, James or William. Heavily disguised, the king made his way to the Kentish coast where a small vessel awaited his arrival. But before he could get away, a party of fishermen trawling for escaping priests netted the king and his companions. They were none too delicately strip-searched, the king's prized crucifix was confiscated, and were subsequently frog-marched to the nearest town. It was only then that James was recognized." News that James had escaped to France had already reached William's quarters, along with an invitation from the Court of Aldermen to come to London. This is local London magistrates inviting William to come. This was a totally unexpected development with complex constitutional ramifications. Almost immediately, his Whig supporters urged him to take the crown, and he was marching towards the city when the unexpected report of James' capture arrived. William soon knew that James had returned to London amid cheering crowds. He halted his own progress to avoid a confrontation. But the Dutchman would not now be denied his triumph. He sent an imperious order that James vacate the city within 10 hours and then dispatch an escort, but not a guard, of Dutch troops to speed him on his way to Rochester. They proved conspiratorially incompetent as James easily escaped and for the second time found himself in a small boat on the Kentish coast. This time he succeeded in sailing to France. After James had fled, there was a lengthy debate in Parliament. Okay, and actually, the Parliament was not James's Parliament, but rather the last members of Parliament of Charles, who William had called up and told them to meet and come up with some, solution. Several possibilities were floated. The Parliament was really gun shy about deposing James. I think in everyone's mind, the events of 1648 and 49 were prominent. They didn't want to just go off and depose the king because it led to such a long period of instability. They were reluctant to do that. So, in the end, there was some people wanted William to be there to be a regent. In other words, they would just wait for James to die overseas, and then Mary would be declared queen. And in the meantime, William and Mary would be, quote, regents. That was one idea. And there was a fairly significant debate between the House of Lords and Commons as to how to go about this. In the end, they decided not to do the regency. In fact, William threatened, if they just wanted him to be regent, he was going to go back to Holland. he was prince or king... his prince there, but he wasn't going to stay in England just to be a regent and wait for his wife to become queen. So in the end, they ended up declaring that James had abdicated the throne that was now vacant. And again, it took quite a bit of debate, but they then offered the crown to William and to Mary, as king and queen. Covenanter writers, both contemporary, Michael Shields, and later, have pointed out that essentially the same reasons were given by Parliament for disowning James as they had given. According to Kishlansky, and I really have little, this is from the Penguin series on British history, I have really very little idea about his biases, and I've only really read that part of the book on the revolution. But according to that, he says, in the end, the agreement was reached. In other words, this declaring that he had abdicated and the throne was vacant. That agreement was reached because the largest number of lords and commons could interpret the resolution in their own way. For the Tories, the abdication consisted of James's flight, the vacancy of his physical absence. For the Whigs, the abdication consisted of his violation of the fundamental laws, the vacancy of his failure to fulfill the contract between ruler and ruled. So, I think even under that, given that interpretation, right, I think it's pretty safe to say that the Whig view was roughly corresponded to the Covenanter view. And it may not have been exact, but I mean, that is essentially the Covenanter view of why James was no longer their rightful monarch and could be ignored. But as according to Kishlansky, it was, that there were more than one view and they both kind of read their own interpretation into it. But in any case, the net effect was the same. The monarchy was subject to the Parliament. Whichever view you had, right? Whether it was just okay for the Parliament to declare he'd abdicated and vacated the throne and left, right? It was still the Parliament doing it by their own decision. Shewison says, sovereignty thus became the result of a parliamentary vote, and the theory of divine right was exploded. Here again was light out of an old window by which the more prescient Covenanters had been guided through the valley of humiliation for half a century and even longer. For by this resolution, the political dogmas of Knox, Buchanan, and Melville, and the ecclesiastical doctrines of Henderson, Guthrie, Cargo, Cameron, and Rennick received the national imprimatur. Okay, about the same time, the Scottish Privy Council decided to relax the persecution of the Covenanters, and even gave instructions to remove the heads of martyrs from the spikes on which they had appeared. Yeah, well, Hewison points out that Shields wrote that they did it so that people might otherwise ask, whose heads are these and why are they up there? Hewison's, I forget what he says, but I think he thought that was naive. Doesn't really say, but I assume he means the other idea is, if you better remove those heads, less people get ideas about what to do with them when there's a change of government. So stick your head on a spike, buddy. That seems pretty obvious to me. That's a save your skin sort of maneuver. Let's see, a convention of nobles and gentlemen meeting in Edinburgh in January 1689 asked William for a free parliament with no required oath and no bishops. Another convention of Presbyterian ministers asked William for the restoration of Presbytery. Hewison says, the society still held aloof from their Presbyterian brethren till they owned their defections, only agreeing to attend meetings for the purpose of convincing of error, but not to amalgamate with the unreformed. As we'll see, we'll discuss this some next time. The final settlement of the Presbyterian Church sort of brought in all kinds of people, from pretty good to not so good, so the societies end up staying out. William called the Scots Convention of the Estates to meet in March of 1689, and on the 3rd of 89, in the 3rd of April, they passed a resolution that James had forfeited the throne. And they did that, and I'm going to read, I won't read the whole thing. They made a declaration of the states containing the about this, the claim of right for William and Mary to take the throne. And I'll read a little bit of this, and I think you'll see that their view probably even more closely aligns with the Covenanters. This is the Declaration of the States of the Kingdom of Scotland, containing the claim of right and the offer of the crown to their Majesties King William and Queen Mary. Whereas King James VII, being a professed papist, did assume the regal power and acted as king without ever taking the oath required by law, this would be Scottish law, and acted as king, and whereby the king at his access to the government is obliged to swear to maintain the Protestant religion and to rule the people according to the laudable laws, and did, by the advice of wicked and evil counselors, invade the fundamental constitution of this kingdom and altered it from a legal limited monarchy to an arbitrary despotic power, and in a public proclamation asserted an absolute power to cast, annul, and disable all the laws, particularly arraigning all the laws establishing the Protestant religion, and did exercise that power to the subversion of the Protestant religion and to the violation of the laws and liberties of the kingdom, by erecting public schools and societies of the Jesuits, and not only allowing the Mass to be publicly said, but also inverting Protestant chapels and churches to public Mass houses, contrary to the express laws against saying and hearing of Mass, by allowing popish books to be printed dispersed by a gift to a popish printer, designing him printer to his Majesty's household, college, and chapel, contrary to the laws, by taking the children of Protestant noblemen and gentlemen, sending and keeping them abroad to be bred papists, making great fonds and dotations to publish schools and colleges abroad, bestowing pensions upon priests and perverting Protestants from the religion by offers of places, preferments, and pensions. Okay, and it goes on to the other things James was doing along these lines. By levying or keeping on foot a standing army in time of peace without consent of Parliament, which army did exact locality free and dry quarters. By employing the officers of the army as judges through his kingdom, imposing them where there were heritable offices and jurisdictions, by whom many of the lieges were put to death summarily without legal trial, jury, or record. By imposing exorbitant fines to the value of the party's estates, exacting extravagant bail, and disposing fines and forfeitures before any process or conviction. By imprisoning persons without expressing the reason and delaying to put them to trial. Okay, and he goes on with more, they go on with more outrages against justice, including the prosecuting people on old and obsolete laws, on frivolous and weak pretenses, subverting the rights of the royal boroughs, sending letters to the chief courts of justice, not only ordaining the judges to stop and desist, see and die to determine causes, but also ordering and commanding them how to proceed in cases depending upon them, contrary to express laws, or it's telling the courts what to do. All which are utterly and directly contrary to the known laws, statutes, and freedoms of this realm. Therefore, the estates of the Kingdom of Scotland find and declare that King James VII, being a professed papist, did assume the regal power and acted as king without ever taking the oath required by law, and hath, by the advice of evil and wicked counselors, invaded the fundamental constitution of the kingdom and altered it from a legal limited monarchy to an arbitrary despotic power, etc., like they said before. What they said before. Whereby he hath forfeited the right to the crown and the throne has become vacant. And then they go on to say that, and whereas his royal highness William, then Prince of Orange, now King of England, whom it hath pleased the Almighty God to make the glorious instrument of delivering these kingdoms from popery and arbitrary power, whereas he called us, several pages here before, then they finally go and declare that William and, yeah, actually three pages I'm skipping over, okay. So they finally do resolve that William and Mary, King and Queen of England, France and Ireland, be and be declared King and Queen of Scotland. And additional details. But anyways, they very much in line with the Covenanter thinking. Okay. James eventually returned to Ireland with a French expeditionary force. He held Dublin. William landed in Carrickfergus, north of Dublin, by Belfast, marched south, and the Battle of the Boyne was held on the 1st of July, 1690. Both forces met up. Again, they were fairly evenly matched in many respects, but the... And interesting, the forces were personally led by James and William. William was actually injured, and news spread that he'd been killed, but he hadn't been. It was basically a grazing wound, but he slumped over. And in any case, the Protestant forces were successful. James fled Ireland, never to return. There were additional battles carried out in Ireland and Scotland, and the Jacobite resistance eventually petered out, although there was still, you know, Jacobite uprisings, what, as late as 1745, so. well, a little bit more on at least one battle in Scotland next week, where Claverhouse was killed at the Battle of Killiecrankie. Okay, so next week I'm planning to cover the Cameronian Regiment, the Battle of Killiecrankie, the settlement, the revolution settlement of the church, why the society people stayed out, and give a very thumbnail sketch of post-revolution Presbyterian history, and then, if there's any time left, what does it all mean? So, are there any questions? Mary. Whigs got to be a name for anybody who was sort of, say, revolutionary. The origin of the name is the same. It's not the same people, although perhaps the same people in different years would have had the same sorts of views. It's hard to say, but that, yeah, I think the name directly follows. It wasn't the same people, obviously. Mike. Oh, the Mother's Day thing. Yes. Next week we'll talk about that. They did. Some did. The society people, what they call rabbled out the these curates, you know, out of the churches, and basically went in and called them out of their house, cut their frock and sent them on their, you know, banished them from the parish.
How about the folks who carried on the actual
Well, that's a good question. I may look at that a little bit more. I mean, most of them would have been... I don't know what happened to all the soldiers. I mean, a certain number of them became Jacobites. You know, Claverhouse, right? He went and led an army for James in Scotland. He was killed. He was killed with a bullet at the beginning of the battle. Don't know really about the rest of them. I mean, a certain number would have just claimed to be soldiers, you know, carrying out orders, I presume. So that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that part of it. Certain, of course, the chancellor and so on, a number of those either fled the country, or Chancellor Perth, he tried to flee the country. He was arrested and thrown in prison for 4 years. So, yeah, at higher levels there were some repercussions, but...
In that same frame, is the Christian response to the un-Christian? As the Jews did at the Holocaust to hunt up their murderers and try to detain them, is that un-Christian? Or would some errors been perfectly justifiable to hunt up these guys who committed this atrocity and put them in their life?
Well, that's a good question. I guess I tend to think if it was done legally, right, that it would be, in my view, it would be perfectly justifiable. I don't think it would be justifiable to just go out and assassinate people. I mean, so I draw a pretty clear distinction between the two things. But if people that murdered, I mean, even in our country, we have no statute of limitations on murder, right? So. So yeah, I think it'd be perfectly possible. And I think, by and large, even from what I understand, even the rabbling that they carried out of these ministers was pretty low key. They just banished them out of the parish, threw them out of their job, which is, I think, the least they could expect. And there might have been some revenge taken on, say, curates that went over the top of a Christian response, but I'll talk a little bit about that next week. So, okay. Any other questions? Alan, would you? Did folks get their land back? I think there was a. I believe there was a pretty long period of sort of settling out all these sorts of claims. I'll try to look into that a little bit. So, okay. Alan, would you close in prayer?